At 5 o'clock the next morning, Rock and his nine-man team showed up in front of the back loading platform of Century City, a large concrete-walled warehouse from which liberators were shipped out all over America. Schechter was standing there impatiently. Five of his weapons team had just finished loading the supplies in cartons and out onto one of the raised loading platforms.
Howdy. Hope we're not up too early for you.
Now please, Roxon, I'm always up at the crack of dawn. As you get older, you need less and less sleep. At the age of 74, I find I must obtain only 3 to 4 hours a night to be sufficiently refreshed.
So what have you got for us this time?
The usual mountain climbing equipment, slip-on cleats, 1,000-pound nylon test, pulley equipment. I think you'll find them much more efficient now. Acid rain tarps. And this time, Rock, I'm giving you all an Alumisynth reflective poncho, which should keep both the sun and the high-rad ground soil off you. We've improved the reflective capability of gamma radiation by 83% and dropped the weight by nearly half.
The other members of the expedition force stood along the landing bay, loading the supplies that Schechter's men handed them onto the brids. The backpacks were ingeniously devised to allow tremendous amounts of material to be stored in 40 different pockets, 20 of them expandable. And the hybrids, at least half again as strong as the horses of old, could easily carry an additional 150 to 200 pounds of field equipment. Rock had chosen the Palomino in Bear Valley, and it had acted calmly. It seemed a highly intelligent animal. The horse looked at Rock as he swung back around to face Dr. Schechter.
Oh, and here. It's an ultralight rad suit, not much bigger than a pack of cigarettes. I know you men don't put much faith in rad suits, but there are hot zones out there that would fry any living thing, even you. So please.
Thanks.
Now, this is something we're extremely proud of, Rock. It's an atomic cell inertial sextant navigation computer. It's half globe-shaped to orient you to the sky and stars, and the lenses let you measure directions, distance between points, and even remember locations. Just place it on any surface. Adjust the small expandable legs beneath it until these four bubbles on top come together and line up. Easy to use. Works off either the sun or the stars, and under a pound.
Hey, McCaughlin. Come here. Schechter's got something for you.
McCaughlin walked around several hybrids, pushing them rudely out of the way, and took the sextant, looked at it bemusedly, and walked back to his own riding brid and four pack brids. He was responsible for all their larger supplies.
Now, Rock, you like to use one type of shell in your 12-gauge pistol, the X-pattern heavy shot, but I've got something that I think could have numerous uses.
No!
These shells are labeled. These are gas. They explode and release an invisible cloud of MR3 gas. Anything within 20 feet will go out like a light. And it's non-lethal. Might feel sick as a horny dog in August, but definitely survivable. Just make sure you're at least 30 feet away. The wind breaks it down molecularly within seconds.
Biodegradable nerve gas. Neat. How many you got of these?
Just the dozen for testing, Rock. Damn nozzle on the gas injector broke last week. All we have are these experimental samples, but they work.
I'll be sure to use one on the first dog pack that finds me appetizing.
And finally, there's the emergency pack, as always. I made this one a bit bigger, because who knows what's out there. But a 5x10-inch bag won't weigh you guys down too much. Poison tabs, anti-venoms with serum and hypo ready to use. These poison things here, by the way, are much more potent than the old ones, Rock. We're using shellfish toxin. Takes 3 seconds. Just a jab of the needle. No pain.
Sounds wonderful.
The med kit has spray bandage, plastisalve, seal gauze, antizones, a mini fluoroscope for locating bullets or shrapnel, and... oh, you know what's in there.
Indeed I do. And I've had cause to use all of them. Well, Doctor, I hope we see you again soon, and that we're all still alive.
And I hope that your mission is a success. God and science be with you, Ted Roxon.
Roxon swung his booted leg up over the Palomino's wide back and pulled the reins ever so slightly to the right.
Free fighters, we move.
The horse walked slowly through a long 10-foot-wide concrete road. The other men fell in single file behind Rock. The multi-layered weaving of netting, branches, and leaves was pulled aside at the end of the square tunnel by automatic motors. Rock and his men emerged into the cool night air of the Rocky Mountains in the middle of thick woods. The branches closed behind them. The half moon, misted over with the high purple clouds of the stratosphere, peeked from behind openings in the puffy layers from time to time as a billion twinkling stars rayed down from the heavens onto the mounted force. President Zhabnov read the reports of the massacre of the KGB flamethrower squads in the Little USA sector of Stalinville with mixed emotions. He was glad that the KGB had looked bad, but it hinted at a serious problem in the American sectors. And what was he to make of the attack on the KGB headquarters there, and the destruction of a major munitions dump? And the letter from Premier Vasily, allowing the use of N-bombs, disturbed him profoundly.
I need to do something to impress the Premier that I can keep order better than Kilov himself. And I mustn't fan the flames of rivalry. But how to demonstrate strength? How to show I support Kilov? How to combine the two?
I've got it!
I'll do what Kilov did. Bomb a hidden American city. In retaliation for the attack on Stalinville. And that will make it look as if I'm supporting the KGB, who were so cowardly attacked in their flamethrower mission. The reports speak of a city called Union City in the mountains of South Dakota, right in Kilov's backyard. Why tell Kilov and let him get all the glory? Why not use this opportunity to strengthen the morale of my United Socialist States Air Force? I will have my bombers attack the Americans in 2 days!
Yes?
Get me Air Force General Lavkov.
Yes, sir.
This is Lavkov.
Lavkov! How are things?
To be honest, President Zhabnov, not good. I've been on duty for 38 hours so far without a break. We've received a number of reports of rebel bands throughout the country, and we've been responding with reconnaissance flights to investigate.
Drop all that. I'm calling a meeting of the Joint Chiefs of Staff for tonight, 9 p.m. in my Oval Office. You will inform whichever of your staff must be in attendance. Make sure they're absolutely trustworthy. You know what I mean.
Sir, I don't...
That night at 9 o'clock, the meeting began. The mood was uneasy, for there had been no meeting like this since the Black Rebellion in the Detroit Fortress back in 82. Then, the army had been called out to decimate 20,000 rioters, resisting a 30% decrease in food rations. Zhabnov gave a speech about the defense of the conquered territories, and just in case one of the officers assembled was KGB, he offered warm praise for Kilov's recent actions.
I think we can all be grateful for Colonel Kilov's recent success with atomic weapons. He has been an inspiration to me. Now, we will carry out our own attacks with atomic devices as well. The Air Force will carry out the attack using 2 neutron bombs. But I want the Army as well to conduct massive maneuvers near Stalinville, so that the civilians and the rebels in that sector will know of the President's determination to have order maintained.
The Air Force will have 10 bombers up within hours of receipt of the neutron weapons.
Fly over Little USA, blacken the skies, the mountains around the area with aircraft.
But, Mr. President, with the equipment we have, the shortage of parts, orders from the Premier to cooperate with Moscow Central's requests, we would be lucky to get 20 bombers up there. Besides, we'll only need 1 if we're dropping 2 devices.
I said 50, Lavkov. Didn't you hear me? This is not just for the rebels' benefit, but for Kilov and even Vasily. I want them to know that the damned Army and Air Force are still powerful here in America. That we can move, and move fast. That we can strike like one of these American rattlers and kill. Do you understand me?
Yes, Mr. President, but...
Well, get as many as you can up there, Lavkov. At least 40. Do you hear me? Send up fighters, anything. I want them all to feel the power and might of the Soviet forces. We need good press in Pravda. How long?
72 hours, Mr. President.
Don't fail me on this one.
Yes, Mr. President. I'll get them up there.
Good. Does anybody have anything to add?
Nobody spoke up. Ted Roxon took the lead as the expedition force left Century City, aided by Brady's crudely drawn map. The line of horses, with their weary riders atop, rounded the base of Twill Mountain, the next tallest mountain after their own Carson's Peak, beneath which Century City was built. Soon they were out of sight of their base. With the moon settling down to some privacy behind the hiding walls of the Rockies, the night became black, inky with the moving eyes of the burning stars following the free fighters as they slowly made their way through winding mountain trails and pebble-strewn passes. The Geiger counters each man carried on his waist, hardly bigger than a pack of cigarettes, were silent. The trees stood tall and healthy. Pine cones littered the ground. It sometimes looked in this part of the country as if there had never been a war, an Armageddon. After 100 years, these forests were starting to come back. But from Brady's account, much of what lay to the northwest was more lunar than terrestrial terrain. This was the last they would see of the old Mother Earth for a while. The next 3 days were fairly uneventful as they made their way through wooded, mountainous land that was fairly healthy and lush. On the fourth day, they left the higher ground and hit the plains. Here, the change in weather conditions had had a catastrophic effect. The wide open country had turned into a virtual dust bowl. Parched with only tumbleweed and occasional struggling cactus growing, the free fighters had to wrap bandanas around their faces and put protective eye coverings over the hybrids as the dust and sandstorms raged around them. They walked slowly, single file, tethered one to another by rope. They kept going for 18 hours. At last, they came to a changing terrain. Still dry, but with vegetation. Palm trees, fields of purple and brown cacti stretching 20 feet into the air. They continued on, making good time. The land was quite flat and easily traversed. They rode for a good 8 hours more before they reached the rim of the pink-misted lands that Brady had mentioned. As the radiation picked up on their counters, they suited up in the anti-rad suits Schechter had given them. They rode into the mist, which rapidly grew thicker. It had a sour taste to it, as if the very air were rotting. The Brids kept spitting out gobs of saliva, as if trying to dislodge the taste from their long mouths. The Geigers went wild as they moved deeper into the pink fog. They could barely see 10 feet in front of them as they traveled over loose dirt and gravel for hours. They kept heading downward at an increasing angle. Rock knew they must be far below sea level now. For men raised in the mountains, the air felt positively thick down here at the lower altitudes. Finally, the mists thinned a bit, and they came to the three volcanoes that Brady had mentioned. The hot mineral baths, too, which the men took instant advantage of to wash the grit and grime of days of travel from their bodies. They camped on the base of one of the dormant volcanoes and slept deep, their muscles relaxing from the heat-giving waters. The next day, the pink mist thinned out as they came upon the expanse of jungle that Brady had described. They headed into the primeval jungle, holding the reins of the hybrids tight as the animals seemed to be quite nervous about the terrain. They moved through the tangled world of beauty and death, through giant ferns climbing impossibly high, through huge multicolored orchids and flowers with petals as big as a man's hand. The going was slow, and the men had to dismount and begin hacking their way through the dense growth with machetes and long knives. After another 3 hours of travel, with the jungle getting denser and denser, Rock stopped as they crossed a clearing.
Let's stay here. I don't want any of these creepers Brady mentioned for a bedmate tonight.
As the darkness descended like a blanket on the already murky jungle, the creepers seemed to begin moving, slowly, twining and reaching out for whatever they could grab. Monkey creatures, lizards, large spiders, all became dinner for the carnivorous creepers, which would slowly twine several of its long tendrils around the creature's legs and shoulders. When it tried to move, it would only tangle itself deeper. It took hours to die, the vines slowly strangling the prey. Then, small needle-like hooks came out and attached themselves to the animals, sucking out blood until there was no more. During the night, the creepers tried to creep into camp. They wove a path around the fires and began wrapping tendrils around Berger's ankles, poking out the bottom of his unzipped bag.
What the hell?
Berger!
Get him off! Get them off!
Berger, don't move!
Oh God, they're gonna eat me! I can feel their needles! I'm gonna die! I'm gonna die!
Jesus, Berger. You fell for the old shoelace trick.
Oh, I was asleep. You were supposed to be guarding.
Oh, yeah. And what do you think?
Look, the packs.
They all turn to look in amazement as the creepers set about opening their packs, poking inside, searching for anything edible. They ran over to their pile of supplies and began hacking away at the vines, which pulled back into the jungle in the darkness. Rock posted more guards for the rest of the night, and they kept a careful watch, patrolling the perimeter of the campsite with torches. The men awoke groggily the next morning. Rock let them have 2 cups of Erickson's Insta-coffee before they broke camp and continued to head at a slow angle of descent. The terrain grew less jungle-like, and they were suddenly upon a long, flat volcanic plain. Rock checked the map Brady had drawn for them. It didn't check. He had been in the jungle for days, and this land ahead looked like a dried seabed. He hadn't mentioned that at all.
Hold up, men.
He took out Dr. Schechter's navigation hemisphere. He set it on the ground and adjusted the 4 thin plastic legs until the 4 bubbles on top of the device inside a tiny plastic globe lined up into one. Schechter had said he had programmed in all of Brady's data, so Rock pressed the off-course readout.
What's it say?
Hold on. This is the first I've used this thing. Here we are. 12 degrees south. Probable destination, 800 miles at a course of 300 degrees. Shit. We've still got a while to go.
Notes from the Underground. A most profound and odd book. Dostoevsky was, in Vasily's opinion, Russia's most gifted writer of all time. But such books on esoteric, non-materialistic subjects were forbidden. The state atheism would not allow itself to be challenged by such radical religious doctrines. After the Great War, the peoples of the world, reeling under the blow of atomic destruction, turned to religion. In Russia, the survivors clung fiercely to the old Russian Orthodox Church. They disobeyed orders to work on Sunday and prayed in secret masses together, spreading not only God, but underground propaganda. The KGB, at that time merely the security arm of the Kremlin, a spy network no longer needed after the war, went ruthlessly after all dissenters and religions, purging all views that the war was a failure. There were mass executions in the Politburo as well. The ruthless KGB blackshirts kept the empire together through the reorganization period. They maintained the premier as a mere figurehead while they swept through the Soviet Socialist Republics, killing all who doubted the party line. The KGB virtually ran the Soviet Empire for 35 years after the war, but when the Great Famines hit in the 30s and 40s, the rioting masses brought a revival of the traditional Russian leadership, the premiership, which again became the most powerful position of authority. With his new powers and the army firmly behind him, the then premier, Alexandr Druzhny, was able to push the KGB down into relative obedience, their powers greatly stripped. And so it had been, until now, Vasily mused. Now Kilov, the cleverest and most ambitious KGB leader for over half a century, wanted the premiership. He knew there were spies, he just didn't know how many. Vasily rose on shaky legs and walked to the window. It was dusk. The changing of the guards was taking place far below the Kremlin walls in front of the Lenin-Drubkin tomb. What had been a foot of snow the week before was now, in August, a wet, muddy mess outside the Kremlin. The ever-present lines of heavily clad women, peasants, and stooped laborers waited patiently in endless lines to see the only icons left in Mother Russia.
We have taken their religion and substituted dead bodies to worship.
He saw it all now. He was forced to see it from his daily reports of starvation, rioting, and rebellion. The whole planet was ready to explode again. The war had all been for nothing. The cultures, the great religions of the worlds, the beautiful wonders, the Eiffel Tower, the Roman palaces, the Acropolis, Paris, Venice, London, Leningrad, Tokyo, all were gone. All were now leveled, radioactive plains, swept away by deadly winds. And all for nothing. The world was sliding backwards in time. Technology had stagnated in most areas for the past 100 years. Each year, the ability to build machines, electrical generators, and weaponry regressed, and the apprentices found the black market more rewarding. They continued to produce tanks and rifles, but all R&D had ceased. Only the huge control station outside of Moscow was kept up to date, as it still kept the 40 spy satellites aloft.